Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, and I want to remind you to grab your free email series on how to communicate with your teen over at mightyparenting.com. We've heard over and over from parents that this is a problem, and we've also seen ourselves and heard from many guests that the way we communicate with our kids contributes to a lot of other problems. So we wanted to give you a tool to help get you started on that. Also wanted to remind you to follow us on social media. We are just Mighty Parenting on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And then we also have our private Facebook group for you to be able to ask questions, hash out problems, whatever you need. So connect with us and share your thoughts and questions with us. Today, we are talking about resiliency. Now, this is something that I know I'm hearing more and more about in the news and across parenting circles, and it is something that I really, really do worry about. I see many examples of this impacting kids' lives now, and then I was talking to a manager recently at a company, and he told me a story about a young woman who came to work in his office. The manager gave her an assignment where she had to draft a proposed action plan. When the young woman brought the plan to her manager, he marked it up with changes for her to make. And after he gave it back to her, she went and quit her job because she couldn't handle having failed in her assignment. And as he told me the story, I was just dumbfounded because this isn't even a failure. This is normal procedure. Nobody gets things right 100% the first time they do something, particularly when they came as instructions from another person. But in her mind, this was a failure, and failure was totally unacceptable. She just had no idea how to deal with this and how it made her feel. And I've heard similar stories from other employers and from college professors. And these types of stories, they just break my heart, but they also motivate me. They motivate me to continue working with parents so that together we can raise kids who can handle the challenges of life, and we can raise kids who are emotionally healthy so that this young woman and others like her don't have to be suffering. So to that end, we have Chris and Holly Santillo with us today. Chris is the founder and head instructor at his martial arts studio, Potomac Kempo. Holly is the founding conductor of Mount Vernon's Children's Choir and a senior instructor at the martial arts school. Together, they have been working with and educating children for more than 35 years, as well as parenting three children of their own. So they are deep in the trenches. They are also the co-authors of the book Resilience Parenting, which is what they're going to talk to us about today, so they can help us understand how we can best serve our children so they can live and launch well. Chris and Holly, thanks so much for joining us here today at the Mighty Parenting community.
Hello, Sandy. Great to be here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
I'm so glad that you guys have tackled this topic of resilience. As I said, this is something that is near and dear to my heart. And you state that resilience requires independence and connectedness, but that our kids are actually disconnected and dependent. What led you to say that this is what our kids are experiencing?
Many, many hours in the lobby of our dojos, seeing, and on the playgrounds too, and just all around in our environment, seeing kids, teenagers and young people alike, unable to talk with their parents, either in a connected way or in a way that leads to independence. Is that fair to say, Chris?
And, just coming off of the story that you just shared, which is such a heartbreaking story of a young woman who went out into the world but wasn't prepared in the ways that she needed to be. So we talk about independence and connectedness, and what we tend to see is we see that some parents have put a great emphasis on connectedness, and you kind of see the archetypal child hiding behind his or her mother's legs, afraid to go interact with another child. Wonderful bond with mom, but not comfortable interacting with other people. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we seem to see a lot of people who are very independent, you know, and this is the teenager often in his or her bedroom playing on their phone, and they get up and they do their thing and they go out into the world, but they don't have good, strong connections with their immediate family, which means that they have trouble forming good bonds with other people as well. And just not seeing enough children who are getting both halves of this whole. And what we think, at the risk of just giving away everything that we have meaningful to say, and it seems to be like, this is the crux of it. I'm just going to give it all away here and then everybody can turn off the show.
The shortest podcast that we've ever done.
But the best, right? That there is a false dilemma. There is a belief that that if your child is independent, they will fail to be connected, or if they are connected, they will fail to be independent. And it's just not true. That independence and connectedness are two parts of a whole, and they are the two halves that make us resilient and able to go out to the world. And so this parent who has a very connected child is afraid of encouraging independence because they don't want to lose the great connection they have. And the person who sees their child and is proud of their independence doesn't want to cultivate connectedness in them because they're afraid that they
it'll soften them
very well. And so they just kind of keep these childs at the ends, but the reality is that, you know, the best amongst us are the people who have both a well-developed sense of connection and independence. And that's everything we have to say.
Well, no, I hate to tell you, but I have questions. So
you've
already got my brain churning, and we'll probably come back to that because I want to dig into that more. However, I think before I ask you more questions about the two of them coexisting, what I really want to do is understand more about each of them. So let's talk about independence. I read your book, which I really enjoyed, and you had the example in there of Amelia and Max. And Amelia was a 4-year-old girl and Max was an 18-year-old boy. And you said already, Chris, you know, this idea of a kid hiding behind their mom's legs, and that's your Amelia example, right? There's a 4-year-old girl hiding behind her mom's legs at her first day at the dojo, is afraid to come out. But you also said, you know, okay, so Max is a scared 18-year-old. He's afraid to say hello to unfamiliar people. He's afraid to go to a job interview or set up a job interview. He put off applying for college until the deadline passed. And what was interesting to me is you guys said that while we're going to have different expectations for the 4-year-old and the 18-year-old, those two problems are the same, that it's a lack of independence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'd like to dig into that a little bit because I think most parents are listening and go, well, you know, a 4-year-old who's nervous about walking into the class by herself for the first time, kind of hiding behind mom's legs, I think a lot of us would just go, okay, you know, I mean, I get that, and brush it off. And what you guys are saying is that this actually is a sign at a young age that our child may not be developing that independence that they need to have.
That's right.
Sure. But it's, of course, a wonderful time to observe it. And, you know, and whether it's 3 or 4 or 5, and every child is developmentally a little different. So we try not to, you know, put any hard lines on it. But when we normalize and accept this, this quote unquote shy behavior, I'm very off-put by the concept of shyness, because I find shyness is just a way for kids to receive attention in a different way. And then parents often reinforce that behavior by giving them that attention. Oh, you're shy, which we think is adorable when 4-year-olds are shy. And they're hiding behind, like you said, the, you know, mother's legs. And then everybody thinks it's so adorable that 4-year-old's hiding behind their legs. And that just creates a 5-year-old who's hiding behind their legs. And, you know, and it's, if the 4-year-old hides behind their legs, that's one thing. But then at 5 and then at 6, you know, like there has to come a time when we get out from behind the legs and we go interact with people. So it's difficult to find the exact ages. And like I said, I'm very quick to point out that every kid is developmentally different, and whether the appropriate age to be out there giving a a stranger a high five and or a handshake or whatever is 3 or 4 or 5 is going to depend on the child and the situation, of course. But we need to make sure that we're moving in that direction. And more than anything, we want to make sure that we understand this arc. We understand that the behaviors that we have at 4 are predictive of the behaviors that we'll have at 18. They aren't the same. You know, that 18-year-old's not hiding behind mom's legs in the same literal sense. But if we aren't moving from the 3-year-old, the 4-year-old being more bold and independent than the 3-year-old, and the 5-year-old being more bold and independent than that, then we do find this 18-year-old who's just terrified of the world.
It makes me think of the fact that we have feelings. We've had this conversation many times in our family, maybe daily even. It's perfectly acceptable, and we're gonna have those feelings. It's how we act upon them that matters, right? And the non-independent 18-year-old who's unwilling to take a step outside his door or outside his friend circle or outside any of those comfort zones, he's having, you know, bona fide feelings. We just need to teach him or her how to turn those into actions that are useful rather than shielding and depleting.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being nervous and timid and whatnot. I'm nervous and
I'm nervous right now. I can barely put my words together.
That as we go into life, we're going to continue to be nervous, but then you need to need to have the rational thought, like, is there a real danger posed? Is there, is this an acceptable risk? That kind of stuff that we need to not be controlled by that. But sorry, you were going to say.
And I think even just the simple acknowledgement of this is scary. It is what you're feeling right now, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times when we're encouraging our kids to be independent, we don't tend to do that. We tend to go, oh, it'll be okay. It's not that's a problem. Right. There's nothing to be afraid of.
And then it feels false. And now we're starting to push our kids away. And so we're leaning too much on the independence part. And it's going to end up taking away our ability to be truthful with our children, right? And have a deep connection to them. So yes, that's the wrong way to pursue the independence, and it will lead to poor relationships.
And we touch on this in the book, that we as parents are very uncomfortable sharing our discomforts and failures and those same kind of feelings with our kids. We don't like sharing ourselves, and that we don't like sharing those thoughts and feelings of inadequacy and fear with anyone, not with our friends or neighbors or spouses or ourselves given a chance. And so we tend to put on this facade of impenetrability to our children, and it damages our ear. I don't know if damaging is right. It misses an opportunity to build connection with our kids, and it also hurts this kind of conversation of independence that we're having. But when I can look at my kid, I say, you know what, I get scared sometimes too. And, you know, let me give you some examples in my life where I was nervous, where I was scared. But then you look at the risks and you look at the rewards and you look at and you decide what should be, if this is the right thing to do. And then you go out there and you try, and sometimes you fail and sometimes you succeed. And, you know, that girl who quit her job because her boss thought that maybe, you know, there could be some corrections on her work. Like, you know, we've all felt that, but we need to learn how to be like, okay, this is what happened now. It's okay to have your work corrected. It's okay to, I agree with you that that's not failing, but in other situations, it's okay to fail as well. That this is normal, and I felt that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and it's restructuring the dialogue and the conversation around failure. There is nothing wrong with failing. It was just, to me, it was a twofold piece of, one, what she's viewing as a failure is not a failure. It's a normal collaborative process. And two, that she believes failure is wrong. I know this is one of the reasons that many people are pushing for and encouraging coding in schools, is simply to teach our kids that things don't always work right the first time. Because if you want to have things not work, write computer programs. I mean, that's the way that goes. And I think this ties into some of the other things you guys say in your book about, you know, this takes time. This takes effort. Chris, what I heard you saying was have a conversation with your child. you know, sit down and talk to them, and a difficult conversation, no less, right? Bear some of your feelings in an age-appropriate way. We have to be smart about this. We know our kids, but doing that not only shows them it's okay, but goes back into, Holly, you've talked a lot about this bridge, this connectedness. And I can't help but see with my own kids that when I share stories from my past, things that have happened to me or things that I'm going through now that they don't see. So example, I am very fortunate. I have two very good friends, one of whom is Judy Davis, who our listeners know because she is the other half of Mighty Parenting, albeit being on sabbatical, sadly, at the moment. And we met in college and just became best friends. I have another friend like that from high school. And there was a point where both my girls were kind of looking for those deeper relationships, and they would look at me and go, oh, you have that. And then I'd be like, yeah, but you weren't around when Mrs. Davis and I got so angry at each other or were so frustrated, or I made her so crazy because I kept doing this and she couldn't talk to me for a while until, you know, she figured out how to deal with this and how to bring it up. And then we had to sort it out. Or you weren't around when we didn't get to see each other or talk to each other for a few years because of life circumstances. Or in high school, you know, Debbie and I had these big fights. But just going back and going, I totally get what this looks like to you. Here's a little peek at the reality of the not so great side of these good friendships and some of the things we've had to work through. And what I saw in my kids first was just a little relief. Like, oh, okay, it's not me. I'm not screwed up. I'm not a problem. This is just life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my kids are tired of hearing about it probably, but you know, I like to recount my epic failure in terms of choosing the wrong major to something that I ended up loathing. The first company I founded and how it went bankrupt, the getting started on my current career by accident, the three times that we almost went bankrupt, you know, all of the, you know, the travails that got us where we have gotten, and we've gotten to what we consider to be a really good place. We're actually currently on a sabbatical, on purpose, traveling around the world. And, where are we right now? We're in Wyoming. I had to look out the window. We're in Wyoming right now. We've never been to Wyoming before. We're in the shadow of mountains, and, we went hiking by a lake yesterday. But all of this is a culmination of every failure and mistake and problem that we've gotten to up to this point. So, you know, we're probably almost a little over the top, I don't know, overshare, because that term has specific connotations. But sharing with our children, you know, all of the things that brought us to this point, all of the things that looked like missteps that turned out to, you know, work out in the, you know, for the best in the end. And that not only makes them comfortable with, oh, well, I didn't get this right, or this problem, I had this difficulty, or I had this failure, this went wrong. But also with the idea, it develops a connection that I've, you know, when I can share with my child, you know, these difficulties in my life, it's easier for them to share their difficulties with me. And our kids don't understand it, but we have a lot of answers. Like, it's kind of cool, like having this whole lifetime of experience looking back. You know, we look at a six-year-old, the problems a six-year-old has. It's like, I've been there. I understand this. But that's only useful if he'll come to you. If you have that connection, then you can leverage your experience to help him, you know, navigate life a little bit better. But if you don't have that connection, then you can't. And I know you asked to talk about independence, but you know, this is how they all connect, that, you know,
let's talk about connectedness. You know, this has come up already a dozen times.
Well, but that's just like, they're connected, like your connection with the connected, you know, the connection you have with your kid.
So no, Chris, you know, let's go there. You know, we keep wrapping around to connectedness. So let's talk about that because it's important.
Sure. And you can't help but do that because connectedness and independence are so closely linked that it is our connection with our child that helps us encourage and develop their independence. And it's only through them being well independent, as well as you being independent, that you have the ability to kind of have the best possible connection. And so logically, so yeah, connection.
Okay. So how can we tell if our child is not connected to us or to somebody?
I went to a seminar recently, and it was a room full of parents who had sent their children to a conference about learning how to communicate and build relationships. And the number one thing that parents said that concerned them is, my child doesn't listen to me. So I would suggest that if you feel like your child doesn't listen to you, that's a failure of connection.
Interesting. Okay. And the other piece of this that was something I wanted to talk about a little bit is, you touched on this in your book and you did it through an example, but I think that as parents, we can confuse time spent together with connectedness. So if we're spending time with our kids, which obviously we do need to spend time with our kids to be connected and to teach them about relationships, does it matter what that time looks like? I mean, is all time created equal, or are there certain things that we should be focusing on during that time in order to create connection? How does that work?
Right. And so that's the whole quality versus quantity time. And I have this conversation lots of times, especially with parents who work long hours, and they're or single parents who alternate custody, and they only have a certain number of hours with their kid each week. We're all kind of working with the hand that we're dealt. The quality is critically important, right? You know, we can sit next to each other, and I can read my book and you can read your book, and we can be in our own little world, or I can stare at mine. I guess the 21st century analog of that, I can stare at my screen, you can stare at your screen. And not be connected. We have to do things differently in order to form a connection there. What's interesting, of course, is it's not always, it's not as simple as talking doesn't mean greater connection than not talking. Right. And looking okay, at
thank you. Right. You gave the book example, and I have a daughter who does feel connection by mm-hmm. the two of us just sitting on the couch and mm-hmm. reading our own individual books, more yeah. so than necessarily being forced into conversation that she doesn't want to have.
Discuss the weather all day. In fact, you know, as adults, Holly and I were joking about this the other day. We met someone at a hot spring we're in Montana. How nice it is to meet someone and have a real good conversation, because so often that when you meet people, you just talk about the weather. Well, there's an analog with our kids of just talking about things that don't matter, or transactional conversation with our kids. Tomorrow we're going to band practice, and then we're doing this, and then I'm going to pick you up here and whatnot. There's no connection built in that. It's necessary, and those conversations need to happen, but talking doesn't create connection, and lack of talking doesn't mean a lack of connection. You know, if you like to sit together and watch a movie, you can form bonds there. Like you said, you and your daughter, you know, you can sit together and read, and you can form bonds there. So there are ways to do it without talking. Talking obviously is going to be part of it as well.
Well, I think, like you said, you watch a movie, or even when we're reading our separate books, at some point I'll ask her, what are you reading? What was it about? And then try to create some conversation that she would appreciate around that, pick up on something that she finds interesting in the book, or she's into mythology and Marvel and all these things. So I can ask a couple of questions about that, and she's really into that. So I think we can pair it, but just not make the assumption that it sounds like just any conversation isn't necessarily connection, and we don't have to have huge volumes of conversation to create connection. Is that what I hear you saying?
Sure. This is a really poignant question for us right now, because we are with our children 24/7, pretty much, as we're on the road. And so we have a lot of quantity of time together. sometimes it's the time away where we feel, wow, we're really developing a connection. No, but you know, we're at every single meal together, and we had a great one just the other day, and I'm trying to sort out in my mind, well, what was it that made it so successful? You know, because instead of doing the elbows off the table, missing.
Holly did a wonderful job of finding things that were of interest to the kids, you know, and she did a great job of asking questions and letting them take turns, making sure that the oldest didn't monopolize the conversation and whatnot, and asked about things that were of interest to them. What are poignant memories to you from, in our case, it was from trip, you know, what's your favorite memory from Romania? What's your favorite memory from Italy? What's your favorite memory from Costa Rica and stuff like that? And they you know, that's of something that's of interest to them instead of interest to us, because that's going to be important in having a meeting.
They love games. We turned the conversation into a game. So there wasn't a lot of pressure, but it was like, oh, it's my turn now to think of the word, and someone has to come up with a memory based on that word. But at any rate, yeah, it boils down to knowing what's of interest to them. I think you said exactly the same thing about your daughter too.
Yeah. And then, so that's all the talking piece and the quiet piece, but then there's a nonverbal component as well that I think gets overlooked a lot, that, you know, the body language as you and your daughter are on that sofa talking, and the, you know, the direction of your focus, despite the fact that there's a book there, and a hand on the arm and eye contact. And, you know, there's all of this nonverbal communication that's part of the kind of conversations that have connection and create connection.
I'm chuckling over here because I am, touch is one of my love languages. And so if somebody is on the couch reading with me, they're going to get touched probably. Unless I have two touch sensitive people in my household, and they certainly will say, hey, I can't handle that now. But I also, there are times where these nonverbal things, like I'll keep looking, just look up at my daughter and then back at the book, like kind of quickly, you know, being silly, goofing around, making faces at her or whatever. And she'll eventually, you know, give me her version of a goofy look, like, what on earth are you doing? And roll her eyes and go back to her book. But there's a little smile on her face. And so that's a little, I think, just a little touch of connection that is intentional and nonverbal. And just, it just was this, she knows that I am aware of her, and, you know, maybe that I like her or like hanging out with her, that, you know, kind of I'm happy to be there with her in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a powerful thing that you just said there, is that I want to be here with you. Like, I am in this space on purpose. Like, I'm not in the room with you because I have to be. I'm not in the room with you because I don't have other alternatives. Like, I am next to you. I could be in a different room reading my book, but I chose to be in this room with you reading my book. And that alone is powerful. But again, this is a theme throughout the book, is it needs to be communicated, you know, and you can do it nonverbally as you did in that case. But I sometimes, you know, pull the kids aside. I want you to know, like, I'm on this trip with you on purpose. Like, I made this choice. I could do anything, and this is what I choose to do. And I think that we sometimes take for granted that our kids know that we spend time with them on purpose, that we, or even that we had our children on purpose. Like, I chose to have children. I wanted you in my life. I wanted, you know, and that I think gets taken for granted. Well, of course my kid, you know, it's that classic, like, why would I bother telling my wife that I love her? Of course she knows. But people benefit from being told those things, and our kids know less than anyone else.
That's really interesting. And it, in my mind, I circled back to the nonverbal signals that we are giving our kids in the opposite direction. When we're tired, it's the end of a long day, we are in a hurry, and they're asking us for something, and we sigh, or we roll our eyes, or we just have that stiff, tense body language. And I hadn't really thought about it before, but I would assume those things would create disconnection with our children.
So it's interesting. This actually comes right out of my instructor training, teaching my staff, is that you should hide your discomfort to the greatest extent reasonably possible, because it doesn't benefit your relationship with your student for them to know you're uncomfortable, unless it exceeds your ability to mask. And then you should be very upfront about it. So the example is, if you're tired because you didn't sleep a lot last night, no one should be like, oh, sensei's tired, right? Like, you should hide that, because you're just not making the world a better place by whining about your tiredness. But if you're really sad because your dog died, and you can't hide that because it's just too much for you to hide, then you should be really upfront. I'm sorry if I seem a little down today. My dog died, and I'm just a little bummed about that. Because lacking, if you fail to name it, then people start interpreting it however they choose to. Oh, well, Sensei's the way he is today because he hates me, or because I did a bad job.
Stuff looks so bad
or,
today.
Yeah, he wishes I weren't in class, or, you know, whatever. Different people will enter, you know, some people will brush it off, but some people will make it very personal. And so when we're tired and it's been a long day, and the reason that we're responding to our children perhaps a little less enthusiastically than we could be or should be, we should name that and say, you know, hey, kiddo, I'm really sorry. It's been a really long day and I'm tired. Give me a second. Let me, you know, answer or do what you want or tell you I'm going to do it tomorrow or whatever's appropriate. Rather than failing to name it and let them interpret that look on your face and the slumped shoulders as, dad feels this way about me, or gosh, I guess I shouldn't have asked about that thing because he's bothered. No, I'm tired and I'm just going to name it and I'm going to say. And I think there are a lot of parallels there.
I really like that. When you were first talking about with your instructor training and you talked about the masking, I'm like, I could see that in an instructional situation, but I'm like, at home with our kids, that's really not going to fly because one, we can't do it. And two, I know my kids pick up on it anyway. they know us so well that the tiniest things happen. But I love that idea of just going, I had a tough day or a long day, or I didn't sleep last night. I'm really tired. I'm really interested in what you have to say, or I really want to help you. Just please bear with me because I'm not functioning at full capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And again, now that I think about it, when I do those things with my kids, again, there's this, oh, okay. You can almost see a slight shift in the filter they're using to interpret our actions and our words and our behaviors.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
It's a tricky interplay, isn't it? I'm thinking a lot about a hike that we took because it really is one of our highlights so far of being together. I thought in terms of the shared experience, we had this really difficult hike and
sharing failure with your children.
You know,
really failed.
It was a failure in many ways. The kids had breakdowns.
I almost had a breakdown.
True tears. I was real close to a breakdown. You know. So the interplay that I'm talking about here, though, is the between truthfulness. You know, like I was uncomfortable. I was very uncomfortable, but at the same time, it wasn't just that I wanted to glide over that for my kids' sake. But I wanted to do it for me. So to paint the picture here, we're on a mountain. Our goal is to get to 11,000 feet.
11,600.
There we go. And at a quarter of the way up the trail, we hit really deep snow. And we're not, you know, we have warm clothing, but we do not have snowshoes. We weren't prepared for this. It's a beautiful blue sky and it's a warm day. And we did not think we were going to be slumping in snow. But that's what it was, you know, feet down, all the way up to our hips with every single step. And we chose to continue on.
Not perhaps the smartest, you know, there were two other groups ahead of us all, without any kids, just with adults, four people from Belgium, and they turned back. And then another mile later, the two from the Czech Republic turned back. And we're like, no, we're going to go. Our six-year-old's leading the way.
They even tried making snowshoes out of pine branches, which we thought was so innovative, but that didn't work for them. And, you know, we turned to the kids, and only one of them was kind of like, yeah, I've had enough, and we were able to muster it all. Okay, but going back to I needed to kind of lie to myself a little bit about how my feet and my hands were feeling, because we'd made a decision to go.
I didn't feel at all. I couldn't feel
it. And we needed to go. Like we couldn't just sit there in the snow and feel sorry for ourselves, because that wasn't gonna get us either out or up, you know. So there's this falsehood in a way that we put to ourselves, or is the teacher who's trying to mask the feelings, or is the parent who doesn't want to show the fact that maybe he or she had an extra glass of wine that night. Or maybe he or she probably shouldn't have watched an extra television show.
Well, I had this conversation with our chemist.
He's like, stop talking about all the vices.
With the six-year-old is, you know, does that heavy, this is actually from a different, much easier hike that our six-year-old decided he was done. You know, we were like only 3 or 4 miles in, and he's tired because he feels like being tired. And I don't even think there was snow on the trail. And he's breathing hard, like, you know, like this kind of like tantrum's the only way I can describe. He's like, kind of grumbling kind of thing. And I, you know, just kind of conversational because, you know, the tone of the teacher is always tries to, we always try to remember. Everything's better when it's a lesson rather than a lecture. It's like, so does breathing like that, does that help? You know, we are at 7,000 feet, you know, does it help you get more oxygen to breathe like that?
No.
Okay. Or are you getting tired?
Yeah.
Do you think maybe if you breathed more evenly, you'd be less tired?
Maybe. You know,
that if you control your breathing and you control your posture, you know, does slumping your shoulders make you feel better or worse? Well, no, it makes me feel worse. So why don't you start trying to manipulate yourself? You know, the world's out there trying to manipulate you as it sees fit, but why don't you try to manipulate yourself in some positive ways? And why don't you smooth your breathing? And why don't you fix your posture? And why don't you fix your gaze on the horizon rather than down at your feet? And, you know, and 10 minutes later, he's whistling. And, you know, because he figured out how to modulate his own state. And,
that's what Chris is. I think you're kind of giving the nuts and bolts of lying to yourself. If you can just assume the posture of feeling good, then
yeah, a little bit of healthy falsehood is to yourself and the world around you.
But at the same time, it's so helpful. You know, it's at one point during that hike, we had to be quite honest with ourselves of, kids, if you need us to carry you out, I don't think we can.
Oh, but that was a great conversation. we are literally 5 miles from the car. There's no one else on this mountain because they're all smarter than we are and they're not here. And I'm going hip deep into the snow. I can't pick up 3 kids and carry you. And so you're going to get out of here on your own 2 feet or not get out of here at all, which is a great conversation. Man, we should edit this part out, the part where we didn't nearly kill him. I think we were fine.
No,
we're
not editing it out.
But the reason I'm glad this story came up, other than the fact that it's front of mind because we're working on our blog post about it earlier today, was that I think it ties very nicely into the story you started us off with about the young woman who felt that getting corrections on her project was a failure, and the idea that failure was unacceptable. You know, both of those missteps there. And you know, you hike all day, you know, it was a 10-hour hike, and you hike and we didn't get halfway to the summit. The trail map, I have an app that kind of traces your route. We didn't get anywhere near as pathetic, but we did what we set out to do, which was to challenge ourselves, hike as far and as high as we could, and get home everyone else safe. So you kind of need to redefine what your success is. You need to look at failure, but by the rational standard, we utterly failed. The goal was to climb Mount Temple and we failed. And you know what? That's okay.
So did you get back and high five everybody? Yay, great failure.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. There was
this was a huge mistake. But then interestingly, it came up 3 days later as, wow, that really was the best day that we've had, you know?
It's a neat challenge. And the minute you take the curse off, it's like, hey, we failed. Like once you get past the idea that failure is defines you, once you know, okay, well, we tried to hike and we didn't make it. Well, we could have also not tried it. I give this speech, I've given it 10,000 times. We host, you know, tournaments twice a year. And as you're judging, one of the most uncomfortable situations in judging is if there aren't a lot of people in your ring and you're like, oh, I have a gold, silver and a bronze and a fourth person, you know, and that happens every once in a while. But the speech is really simple, is there are hundreds of people who could have been in this division who didn't sign up. Like you beat them, you showed up. We didn't have to fail to climb Mount Temple that day. We could have not gone there. We could have sipped hot cocoa somewhere instead of hiking that mountain. Like
we could have turned back with the Czechs who were kind of like, I don't think it's a really good idea to go much farther, hint, with your 3 children.
They were like 6 inches taller than each of us, and they were strong. They had their bear spray. We didn't even have bear spray. I don't know. You know, they had equipment. They had poles. Like they were cool and tough and strong. They had waterproof pants. Oh my gosh, that would have been so cool. But you know, we could have not gone. You know, that woman who submitted the project, like she could have not done that. Like she succeeded by doing it. There was someone else there's another young lady that same age who is on her mother's sofa right now, doesn't have a job isn't trying. And that we need to put ourselves out there, and it's a victory. Every time we put ourselves out there, it's a victory. The only way to be certain that you'll never fail at anything is to never try.
I want to take a minute to define resilience, because, you know, it's so related to this conversation.
It's in the title of the book.
Well, and that too. But, you know, with regards to this hike, we needed to decide whether we are going to stay strong, you know, and no, we're going to get to that summit.
Come hell or high water.
Come hell or high snow.
Then tie it to the story. So resilience is defined as strong, adaptable, and able to recover.
That's right. And, so we could have been strong. And
we tried strong for the first 6 hours.
And it would have meant sleeping under a rock, because it would have taken a really long time. And that would have been staying strong.
That would have been bad.
But then we realized that we needed to adapt. You know, being resilient means also having the tools to which you can use to be flexible. It's not just about rooting yourself so firmly in the ground. It's about bending when bending is necessary, right?
Well, and if I may, like, it's strong comes first. And we did. Like, when the going got tough, we kept going.
Yeah.
And that's always kind of your first answer in resilience. So that things got hard, you don't immediately adapt. You stick with it. And then you, when you realize that this is too much, then you adapt.
Yeah.
What you said in the book, I just want to toss this in right here, because you talked about bending, and it reminded me that you had, you said that being resilience is being live like bamboo, deeply rooted, but flexible in the wind.
That's right.
Who wrote that? That sounds good.
Yeah, you guys are, that was amazing, isn't it? But that gave me such a great visual, and it tied in to what you were talking about, those roots of the independence and the connection, but still having that flexibility.
Yep, absolutely. That's how I saw it too. And there will be breakdowns. That's the other thing that we have to be so truthful with to ourselves and to our children. There will be times when you utterly fail, you come to tears, or some part of your body breaks, or, you know, a relationship breaks. And there are ways to work with that. And one of those ways is having a great connectedness to people around you. You know, at one point we had a straggler back on the trail, and he wasn't moving. He was completely in tears, and he needed help.
By a straggler back on the trail, she means one of our children.
One of our children.
Our life.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it occurred to me, you know, I was like, this is a breakdown, and this is the time when you have a good, strong bond with someone who's going to come help pull you through. And that's why we still need a connection. Resilience isn't about being on your own and able to summit that mountain without any help. It's being a network of people that can help you, because there are always times when we get lost. Yeah.
And that's kind of the whole point, that independence will carry you a long way in this life, but there are always things that are bigger than us. There are always challenges that are too great for us to handle ourselves and recover from ourselves. And that's why the other half of resilience is that connection, is having those people who will pick you back up and help you and support you and let you sleep on your couch if necessary, or, you know, whatever form it takes. But that's why the second half is always that. And then to loop back, the first half is always independence, because I don't want to hear about your hangnail. I'm not, you know, you can't turn to your network every time. It's like, oh, I can't fill out, I'm 23 years old and I can't fill out a job application. Will you do it for me? It's like, no, I can't fill out your job application for you when you're 23 years old. I can't do that. You have to be independent. You need to do that one on your own. Give me a real problem that actually evokes sympathy, and then I will support you and I will give you my life and my blood, but I won't do that for you.
Well, and there's still a difference between supporting and doing for you. And yes, that's one of the things you talked about as well, is that as parents, we tend to err on the side of taking the easy road rather than dealing with the challenge and the time and the effort and the energy that it takes to encourage our kids to become independent.
Yeah.
Because it does take time and effort and energy to teach them to do it themselves.
Have you run across this new term? I don't know if it's catching on. Snowplow parenting.
Oh yes, actually, it was Dr. G was on one of our first three episodes, and she talked about that in there too. That snowplow parenting. That was great.
It just breaks my heart. Just the idea. And for any of your listeners who haven't heard this term before, the idea of just pushing all obstacles out of your child's way, you know, and then the extreme example that came out, I guess it was a couple months ago now, and it was a scandal at college where parents faked some entrance exams, make bribes to get kids into college. I don't remember all the sordid details, but it just seems just heartbreaking. The worst one of all was the child who took the ACT at home, proctored by his mother. And meanwhile, someone else was taking it for real, and that she had paid to take the test for him with his identification, but she didn't want him to know.
So So
he took it at home, and then like she threw away the results, and this smarter kid took it for him. And like, I don't know how that mother thinks that he's going to go out into the world and have a job and be successful in life. Like, sorry, it just makes me stutter. Like, I can't.
Well, I still wrestle with it. Anytime my kids say, "Mom, can you help me with this?"
No.
It's not what I say. It's so funny. In my mind, I don't know why, but that translates to, "Can you do this for me?" I'm still stuck in the time when, "Can you help me?" at 2 years old meant, "I need you to do this for me." And I'm learning that even just saying, "Well, have you looked over there?" or "What have you done so far?" That is help.
That is help. And Holly, I love that you brought this up, because it's about the parents. We have to take time. We have to learn how to do these. We have to learn how to help them. We also need to work on ourselves, because I think another piece that comes into it, especially Chris, like you talked about this college scandal, I think for parents, fear is a huge factor in also busyness and our own exhaustion and stress. It is faster and easier to do things ourselves. Just like when they were, you know, two and wanted to pour a gallon of milk, it was going to be a lot faster and easier when we did it ourselves, because if they do it, there's gonna be a gallon of milk on the floor that we then have to clean up. But this fear, I think, is even more insidious, because we start doing that. We start snow plowing. We start pushing obstacles out of their way. And the more we do that, the less skill they have. And then the stakes grow. So we even get more afraid. You know, in middle school, maybe they forget their gear for whatever sport they do, and so they can't practice. And since they weren't at this practice, they don't get to play in the big game. And, yeah, you know, in high school, now it's bigger, right? Maybe you're letting them pick their classes and they didn't complete a course they need to graduate on time, or they get in a car accident, or they can end up in the legal system. And it's really, really scary. Mm-hmm. And I think that as parents, you know, we let that fear stop us from allowing them to make decisions or take action or accept consequences.
Yep.
Yeah.
I know my girls are now both in their 20s, and it has been very, very scary to let them make their own decisions and do things. And it doesn't mean that we can't be there for them. Holly, you gave a perfect example. So my daughter, who is 22, is living away from home this summer, working a summer job, does not have a car, and is essentially on her own. I mean, she has acquaintances on campus, but not close friends like she would normally have. And we got the phone call last night that she's crying because she hurt her foot, and that's how bad it hurts. And we're sitting there and we're trying to go, you know, what do we do? We're 100 miles away from her. And does she need to go to the emergency room? And there isn't even any place in this tiny town she can go. But rather than telling her any of that, we had to go back to the same thing. Well, what do you think? You called us. What is it that you're looking for from us? You know, we had to go, it's okay for us to be afraid, but it doesn't serve her if we just take over. And so we've already had, in less than 24 hours, we've had 3 conversations, including a FaceTime with her to look at her foot. She's like, well, this is what it looks like, and this is what it feels like. And I talked to our doctor, and this is what she said. And we're like, well, what do you want to do? Instead of telling her how to do it. But those stakes get bigger, and the fear grows. And I'm wondering if you guys have suggestions for parents on how we can deal with that to still allow our kids to be you know, to do things, to become independent, to learn the skills they need, and to be connected, because they get hurt in relationships too. You know, I think we can tend to try to get over-involved in their friendships and their relationships and things. And granted, the really probably the most important connection is with family, but we can also interfere with their ability to connect with other people because we're afraid they'll get hurt or afraid the person will use them or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the first step is to start as soon as we can, because just like you said, the stakes just get higher and higher. You know, so whether you have a 4-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 24-year-old, you know, the sooner that you begin this process of teaching rather than doing for them, the better. You know, if you say, you know what, that's a great thing, I'll start next year, then it's just going to get harder and more difficult. So the sooner that we can begin that process. But I we're very quick to point out, you know, we're parents like everybody else, right? My child comes to me and asks for help or an injury or whatever, you know, I want to make everything right and I want to go fix this and taking 3 steps back and saying, you know what, this is teaching and this is an opportunity. Every moment's an opportunity to teach. And if I miss this opportunity to teach and I do this for my child, well, you know, we need to catch up this ground somehow. And, so whenever possible, whenever we have the time and the energy and whatnot, to use that moment to educate, so that, and then we talk about this again in the book, that each lesson is specific to the lesson, is specific to that instance, but it's also can be generalized to cover more situations. So, you know, if we can talk about your daughter's foot, and I hope it's doing better. You know, we could, if we taught the lesson poorly, it would be very specific to this instance and this foot and this injury and whatnot. But if we're, you know, if we're dealing with it the way you described, then we're talking about the kinds of decisions. Well, you have an injury, you know, here are some of the options whenever you have an injury of any kind. You know, this is how we might assess the level of severity. This is how we might talk about, you know, what do you think in these situations? How does it apply? You know, how, and then there's an opportunity, especially after the sense of urgency is over, to loop back and say, you know, let's talk about that some more and see how we can generalize this. So, you know, what if you fall and break your arm? You know, how would that translate and how we work through the situation, you know, correlate? And, because we can never, and I think every parent realizes this, we can never teach them everything that they're going to need to know. And we can never deal with every possible situation. We can never deal with every potential scenario. But what we can do is start building a base of knowledge and comfort.
I think also once we feel like we've done a great job of educating, our fear is going to have to be given away to trust. You know, I have another little story, and it's one of those small things, one of those stepping stones that we've been taking up to the big stuff that we experience as teens and as adults. We were hiking again, this time on a flat trail, no snow, by a river, and the boys really wanted to cross the river on this huge tree. And I took a look at it first, you know.
Oh, it's the falling in the river story. I thought you were going to do the getting lost story. I never know which one.
So we're up there, and I'm thinking, okay, the rushing water is going fast, but it is shallow. So if they were to fall in, I think we'd be all right. Sure, guys, you can cross that tree. So we took a moment to talk about what it was that could potentially happen and how they would deal with it if one were to fall in. So what are you going to do? What's your plan? And they came up with grab for the branches. And I'm looking at this smooth trunk. I'm like, maybe, well, what else could you do?
Plan B.
Well, but I noticed, Holly, you didn't say that won't work. You went, right. Okay, and what?
And what else might you try too? That's always good, right? Anytime you can say yes versus no, so good. So important in parenting. And they said, well, and I pointed out that, well, the water is not too deep. Oh yeah. Okay. We could probably stand up and be fine. So they start crossing the trunk, and sure enough, my youngest, he's 6, falls into the water, and guess what? He found a branch to grab onto. And so this is the moment of trust.
I'm really glad that you didn't say you weren't paying attention when it happened, because I hate it when you mention that
You hate that part. The moment of trust is I know we had that conversation, and I think he's going to be able to do it, because all of my parenting instincts, watching him, you know, he is being swept down the river. He's gripping for all his life, but his body is horizontal with this, the force of this water, you know, and his head's above water, but he's struggling.
You don't have a good relationship with Child Protective Services, do you, Sandy?
I'm interrupting. He's struggling. He's verbally having a hard time. And I want to go save him, but I didn't. And not only that, the coolest thing was that it wasn't me to give him the answer. It was the other people in his support network, the two brothers who had
his
made
eight,
land
brothers.
Said, "Remember, Seth, find your feet." And none of us, aside from that help, did anything for him. He got up on his own two feet. But that fear was real, you know?
Right.
I was like, wow, okay. And I had to just kind of sit tight.
I had to force myself to sit tight. Yeah, I think there's a reminder here. We said to talk to our kids about their feelings and say, it's okay. It's normal to be afraid. So I just want to remind ourselves as parents, it's okay. It's normal to be afraid. It is also part of our physiology to do everything we can to make that fear go away. As parents, though, we need to go, okay, I get 1,000 years of evolution or whatever, and my child is not in imminent danger. What is in their best interest is for me to just be here in my fear and let them deal with this.
Because one of the worst illusions that we can perpetuate is the idea that we will be able to and will choose to extricate them from every situation. And when they're 6 months old, that's a totally reasonable thing for them to think and feel, that anything goes wrong, mom and dad are going to save me. But somewhere between there and 18, they need to know that that's just not true. Otherwise, they will take outsized risks. You know, when we go to a playground and we see the parents of younger children, you know, hovering beneath their child on the playground, ready to catch them if ever they have a misstep on a ladder, they are creating the same idea. That's the same behavior that creates the 16-year-old driving recklessly because somehow in the back of their head, they have this notion that nothing can possibly go wrong. That'll save me. It's just not true anymore. Like eventually, you know, we talked about it on the mountain. Like we literally got to the point where I couldn't have carried them out. And which is probably earlier than it goes with normal kids, but certainly when they're, you know, 16 or 17 or 18 and driving on their own, or when they're out of the house, like there exist situations, you know, your daughter was 100 miles away when she hurt her foot. You could have driven there, but you know, other 22-year-olds are in Japan.
Right.
And, you know, you can't get there you know, hiking in a remote mountain range or whatever, you know, there are situations where you couldn't intervene if you wanted to.
Exactly.
And if they don't know that, if it not intellectually, but like emotionally, if they don't realize, you know, then they run out into traffic because they're sure that mom and dad would never let them go out, do anything dangerous, and bad things happen.
I just see this as preparing me for when she goes to study abroad this fall.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
Breathe, mom, breathe.
Where's
and
she going?
I have so many more things I would love to talk to you about. The piece of comfort for me is that you guys, I have many of these thoughts from reading your book. So I know things are covered in there, but today we learned that resilience is being strong, adaptable, and able to recover, giving our kids tools to be flexible. And to be resilient, our kids need to have independence and connection, and they need both of these things. And we need to foster, encourage both. Oftentimes you said one is stronger than the other, and parents will hesitate to work on the one, to foster the one that isn't as strong because they think it'll take away from the other. And that is not true. We can give our kids both in a very healthy way. So we need to educate our kids. We need to teach them, take all the learning moments, teaching moments we can find in life. And you guys have a beautiful section in the book about doing that. And there are things I wanted to talk to about that. Maybe we can get you back. But we need to educate them, then allow fear to give way to trust. And remember to tell our kids, but also to remember ourselves that fear is okay. And Chris, I love this. This is going to be one of the quotes from the show. If we always save them, then they will take outsized risks. So I want to thank you both so much for sharing all of this with us. But for anyone who's listening who wants to hear more from you or get your book, could you please share your website?
Absolutely. ResilienceParenting.info. Yeah, ResilienceParentingInfo. And then, of course, the book's available on Amazon and lots of other places.
Okay, great. And we always have it at mightyparenting.com in the show notes for today's show. So you can find that there on our podcast page. And if you're coming in later and you need to search it, just search for Chris or Holly's name and you can pull that up easily. So thank you, Mighty Parents, for being here today. We appreciate you. Remember that if you're here, you are a Mighty Parent. You're doing a great job. Keep on keeping on. Keep doing what you're doing and keep learning and working on yourself and modeling for your kids. Thanks so much for being here, and we will see you next week.